We talk a lot about the Bible on this podcast, but if you're someone who hasn't read the Bible for yourself before, or if you're someone who wants to go deeper, it can be really helpful to have a Bible study guide to follow. Yarrow Bible Studies can help you grow in your relationship with God and find answers to the questions that are on your mind. Yarrow Studies are very visually inviting, and they give you space for reflection at the same time as guiding you through the Bible so you can know what it says and what it means for your actual life. No matter where you're coming from or what season of life you're in, Yarrow is the Bible study guide that will help you unearth the truth of Scripture so it can take root in your heart and inspire you to go deeper in your relationship with God. Yarrow offers beautifully designed inductive Bible studies and a free digital app. If you're looking for a place to start with Yarrow Studies, why not grab a copy of their first study, Known, which is all about identity in Christ. You can shop at yarrow.org now and save 10% off with the code ConfrontingChristianity10. You're listening to Confronting Christianity, a podcast of Training the Church.
Because science, I mean, can't extend all the way to the feelings. And then as a scientist, you can either say, well, I have to deny consciousness exists, or I have to say, well, maybe there is something that I can't really cover with science.
Stephen Hawkins had a view along these lines. When we look at artificial intelligence and say, okay, actually, you're a computer, you don't really have a self, that actually we should flip that back and say, according to science, our sense of self is just an illusion.
I mean, if you go all virtual, right, then the danger is that you kind of get detached from reality, and that's a problem for the AI system as well, right? I mean, if it turns out the longer they go on, the more nonsensical the conversations get because there's no grounding in reality.
Hi, this is Rebecca McLaughlin, and I'm here with my new friend, Max Riesenhuber. Max is a professor in the Department of Neuroscience at Georgetown University Medical Center, and he is co-director of Georgetown's Center for Neuroengineering. Max's research uses computational modeling, brain imaging, and EEG to understand how the brain makes sense of the world and how these insights can be translated into neuromorphic AI and augmented cognition applications. Max obtained his master's degree in physics from the University of Frankfurt in Germany and his PhD in computational neuroscience from MIT, which is a short walk from where I live. He's received several awards, including Technology Review's TR100. You have to tell me what that is, Max. One of the 100 innovators, 35 or younger, whose technologies are poised to make a dramatic impact on our world. And he held an NSF Career Award. Max, it's a delight to have you on the show. If this is a show, I guess it's a show.
Max, we'll put one on.
So tell our listeners how you and I first connected, because it's kind of fun. I enjoyed it anyway.
I'm a long-time listener of your show, and I thought, well, it'd be interesting to also talk AI, because I think it's really interesting for Christians to think about the implications and what the limits are, right? I mean, there's a lot in the media about, like, well, these are going to be taking over the world, and I think we as Christians have a unique vantage point to which I think is helpful in the discussion.
Yeah, as I recall it, Max, you emailed me and said, I think you should have an episode on AI and had some interesting ideas. And I said, great, do you want to be on the episode and do that? It's dangerous to contact me. Tell us first, I'd love for everyone to hear a little bit about your own research and what first got you interested in neuroscience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, well, actually, I started out, I wanted to do AI because I think it's cool to have computers act the way people do. And then kind of realized, well, I mean, we're trying to get computers to act intelligently, but we don't even know what real intelligence is. And so you're trying to copy something and they can't even see, so to speak. And then pivoted to do neuroscience. And our brain is so cool, right? 3 pounds of fat between your ears and can do amazing things like power of a light bulb and enables us to have this conversation, for instance. And so just figuring out, so in our research, we try to understand how does your brain make sense of the world, right? I mean, seeing now, I see your face, right? And hear your voice. And then we can actually extract meaning from that. And once we understand that, we can have computers do it the way people do, or we can combine brains and computers. That was the augmented cognition part. So We can see, get kind of the best of both worlds. And then we can do things we've never done before. So for instance, like have people perceive speech through touch and then couple the brain parts in a new way. So yeah, a lot of fun stuff.
Gosh, yeah, no, that's like delightfully drinking from a fire hose. I mean, I guess it's
MIT, right?
Right, that's MIT. I know, goodness me. We have some students from MIT in our community group and in our church. And I'm always saying to them, gosh, you guys are really living the hard life, because I know almost every other university does all this grade inflation and blah, blah, blah. And MIT, it's brutal and ruthless. And they...
I guess you're used to Harvard, the liberal arts school down the road.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Harvard's and walk in the park compared to MIT. Anyway, aside from that, so my guess is that most people listening will have some level of awareness about the recent advances in artificial intelligence. And in particular, I think in large language models like ChatGPT, I feel like that's kind of captured the headlines more than most. And these have been, you know, really good at mimicking human conversations, even, you know, writing essays for undergrads who don't want to do the work of writing their own essays and would rather have a computer do it for them. My guess is that a lot of people are a little bit hazy on the details. So you've given us kind of the first taste of the sorts of advances that are happening at the moment. Can you give us like the 2-minute briefing on state of the art right now, where we are and where we might be about to go?
Sure. Yeah. So large language models, in large part, kind of tips it off a bit, right? That these are neural networks, artificial neural networks that are trained on literally billions of documents, billions and billions. And then they have a trillion parameters, and they're trained to, on the documents, to see, okay, what words follow one another. And it doesn't just look at one word, but it looks at the whole document, so to speak, and then says, okay, well, given that document I've just looked at, what might be the next word? So you train it, and then it gets these regularities, and then once it's trained on that, then you give it a new prompt, and it tries to see, okay, well, what's the next word that fits? So for instance, and the cool thing is it doesn't just do that from one document, but it builds these statistical dependencies from a lot of documents. So for instance, if I talk about Shakespeare, right, then I might know, okay, deer is like leaf or whatever it is in like Shakespearean English, right? And then I say, well, the host of Quintilian Chatty is Rickard Wolfman, and then letters you start with deer, and so it has all these little connections and the regularities, and then I can ask, well, how would Shakespeare start a letter to the host of Confronting Christianity? And then it would say, leave Rebecca, right? Because it has all these statistical regularities. And and so it's very simple, but the power really lies in the large part, right? That you have all these documents that it went through that then make you produce the right answer. Well, actually, not really right. I mean, the kind of fitting answer, but the problem is there are a lot of other things that fall by the wayside.
Gosh, I now really want to ask ChatGPT to write me a letter from Shakespeare. It made me so happy, but I'm not going to do that. I read a novel last year called Clara and the Sun. It was really interesting. It was written from the perspective. It was kind of in this semi-dystopian world where parents would buy an artificial friend for their teenagers, i.e. a kind of artificial intelligence that looked entirely human and kind of functioned humanly, but who wasn't actually human. And it's really, I mean, it's actually kind of a painful book to read, because once the teenager then sort of is ready to go off into the world, the AI, the artificial friend is kind of retired and basically left on the junk heaps, just to spoil that book for anyone who was thinking of reading it. Although there are other things, there are other twists and turns in the story, so I haven't completely spoiled it. And I think that novel, it explored quite profoundly, because it gave us the perspective of the AI. You know, we saw through her eyes and we felt her feelings, even when she was sort of not really even fully aware of her feelings. It's beautifully written. Some people would say that maybe we're not quite there yet, but very soon we will be at a point where these artificial intelligences have become not human, but meaningful beings, and that we should have a moral responsibility towards them, think of them as a kind of who rather than a what. What are your thoughts on that, as a scientist and as a Christian?
I think if you talk to the LLMs, right? I mean, they're respond in complete sentences. So it's easy to think like, okay, there must be a person like me on the other side, right? Because it can produce these sentences. And yeah, I mean, for thousands of years, I mean, the only people could do that. But the issue is like underneath the hood, the nice thing is we know what these programs do, right? I mean, it's just a computer program that tries to pick the next word. And that's very different. So beware, like Murphy says, complex problems have simple, easy to understand, but wrong solutions, right? And so here you just have one principle. I'm just going to pick the next word. And it turns out then, that doesn't even care about the truth, right? So like for us people, it's very important that we have the truth, because that kind of what enables us to build community, right? That that we have this basis that we say we care about and that we can all agree on more or less, right? But so the AI system, the LLMs, is just, okay, I want to predict the next word. And the problem with that is it means that, you don't care. Does this actually correspond to the truth? I mean, just like, does this fit? And so it makes for a nice conversationalist, but so that's one issue. I mean, we humans care about the truth, right? And then, of course, there's no idea of like a consciousness, right? I mean, of course, artistic license, the writer can write all they want, but there's no self, right? For us humans, right, we have this idea of a self, and so we can actually move between, okay, what's out there, what objectively is, and what our desires and beliefs are. And now, computer systems, I mean, the program LLM, right, again, it's just predicting the next word, so there's no self, there are no desires, so there are no emotions, it doesn't feel like anything. So the network doesn't care if you turn it off or not. I mean, it's like the like a sheet of paper doesn't care if you rip it in two, right? It's just a computer program, it predicts the next word, you turn it off, that's it. So there's a lot of things, a lot of aspects that just these network models don't even capture about human intelligence and sentience.
Okay, I'm going to flip that around and play sort of almost devil's advocate here, because you've made the case that these AIs there isn't a self there. I vividly remember a number of years ago, I was at an event at MIT with MIT professor Alan Lightman, and he, among other professors, was sharing what he believed about humans and about God and about the world. And he, I think, comes from an agnostic perspective. And he said this: our consciousness and our self-awareness create the illusion that we have some sort of ego power, some I-ness, some unique existence, when in reality, we are nothing but bones, tissues, gelatinous membranes, electrical impulses, and chemicals. So from his perspective, as a physicist who's also interested in philosophy and literature, and I think from some other scientists' perspective, famously Stephen Hawking had a view along these lines. When we look at artificial intelligence and say, okay, actually you're a computer, you don't really have a self, that actually we should flip that back and say, according to science, our sense of self is just an illusion. We're really just computers, but we're in these sort of fleshy cases rather than in kind of harder cases.
Yeah, no,
what does Professor Riesenhuber say?
Well, you can ask Alan if he really listens to life like that, that he thinks he's just a gelatinous mass, right? I mean, he probably thinks he has a self, right? But I think it's basically, yeah, I mean, if you're as a scientist, say, science only covers natural phenomena, right? And then you hit a wall when you really try to understand the human existence, like consciousness, feelings, right? It's like David Chalmers, right? I mean, 30 years ago came up with this hard problem of consciousness, right? And it's how come this all feels like something? And we're still at the same point where we were 30 years ago, right? Because science, I mean, can't extend all the way to the feelings. And then as a scientist, you can either say, well, I have to deny consciousness exists, or I have to say, well, maybe there's something that I can't really cover with science. I mean, there's a lot you can do about the brain, right? I mean, the brain is real, right? It's in the natural world. But then there are other aspects of the human existence. As also like atheist philosophers like Thomas Nagel from NYU. I mean, he says, well, there's even truth, right? There are emotions, desires, values, right? All stuff that we can't really account for with this reductive materialist framework. But then we can't say, that it doesn't exist, because that runs counter to our human experience.
So when he says there is truth, though, I mean, taking God out of the equation here, what is truth even, and especially what is moral truth?
It sounds like Pontius Pilate, right?
Well, so, yeah, indeed. So, he asked the right person, at least Pontius Pilate. Yeah. He just didn't wait for an answer.
Yeah. Well, I think so truth is, and we can go all postmodern, right? But again, I mean, it's not how we live our lives. We can say it's relative or whatnot, right? Or it's a power claim. But in the end, we all live in the real world, and I think it's very helpful because it kind of grounds us, right? That there are things we go out there and you and I can agree on it, right? We look up and say, well, the sky's blue. And I said, yeah, the sky's blue, right? And so so that's very important to ground us. And it's and as I said, it's important to build community, right? Because there's something we have to agree on. That's a way we have to interact. And I mean, if you go all virtual, right, then the danger is that you kind of get detached from reality, and that's a problem for the AI system as well, right? I mean, if it turns out the longer they go on, the more nonsensical the conversations get because there's no grounding in reality, right? And so basically, well, anything is possible, like if you start to fantasize, but again, that's not really what how we live our lives, and it would be a very sad existence if there weren't anything like truth, because it would be hard for us to agree on anything.
Mm. So you said that the longer AIs go on, the more nonsensical they become.
Right.
I'd love for you to unpack that a little bit when it comes to questions of ethics, because I think one of the things that we're seeing, and that, you know, there are various kind of news flashes about at different points, is artificial intelligence is being asked ethical questions and coming up with extraordinarily wrong answers. I mean, the level of wrong that, regardless of where somebody's coming from, religiously, at least if they live in our sort of modern Western community where we have some shared ethical values, which I think, you know, we could probably agree tend to come from Christianity originally, but, like, you know, leaving that aside for a minute, do you think we should be concerned about the ethical direction that AIs are taking us in? Talk us through that little can of worms.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me, so Mark Knoll wrote this book, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, right? And this, that there is none, right? And so the scandal of ethical reasoning in AI is, well, there is no ethical reasoning, right? There's because...
It was a bit of painful equivalence there.
A little dig. Well, the issue is, there's no, again, no grounding, right? I mean, for us humans, right, our ethics, I mean, we all feel pain, we feel pleasure, right? And so we can kind of ground that to these experiences. But AI systems, again, there are no feelings, right? So the AI system just learns from billions of documents, okay, well, I should probably say child abuse is bad, right? Or walk at the beach is good, right? And but there's no grounding experiences. Even infants, right? Before they can talk, they have an idea of fairness, for instance, right? And so for the LLMs, I mean, all they know about ethics, well, is whatever's in the documents you train them with. And that's an issue because, becomes very important, like, what do you train it with, right? I mean, if they got trained with, like, the literature of the Third Reich, right, they would have very different ideas about, what should we do with certain groups of people? And and that's because there's, again, no grounding in any kind of values, but it's just, well, regurgitating what's in the documents. And it's very problematic. I mean, you might know Isaac Asimov's, like, the robot novels, where they had this cute idea of, like, having a few rules that give robots ethics. And then all kinds of problems happen because it turns out, well, what is harm, right? And so if you have no way to ground that in, then you're basically at the mercy of, okay, whatever do you think might be a fitting word there, right? And and that's not how ethics work.
Ever since Jesus's female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, Seminary President Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold. Yeah. I mean, you gave the example of sort of Third Reich documents. I think the one that was occurring to me yesterday was, you know, clearly the internet is chock full of horrific pornography.
Right.
And if we were to train artificial intelligences on sort of transcripts from pornographic videos, we would be training them into, you know, horrific lines of ethical reasoning and what is good and what is harm and what's, you know, what is pleasure, what is pain. And yeah, we're in extraordinarily dangerous territory there.
There's actually, there's a whole new job that came up. This thing called reinforcement learning with human feedback. So all these people now, and the big companies used to already have people who like in third world countries, right, get paid very little to watch all these graphic images, right, to kind of triage what we here get to see. And now in the same way, they're being paid to like look, rate the answers and then see, okay, well, does that live up to our standards, right? And without that, we'd be seeing a lot more crazy answers from these LLMs. I mean, in the early stages, like Bing, I mean, there was this well-known example of, is it safe to boil a baby? And then being told, yeah, it's safe, right? I mean, it's not going to hurt you. It's going
right. to, of safe course, for we him. Know it. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And so those are all things now that are kind of being patched. It's kind of like playing whack-a-mole, right? That this idea that say something crazy. So now we teach the system, don't say that again. Rather say that, right? And but again, you have a trillion parameters. I mean, think about a trillion. Like it's like you and I. I mean, we each have like 1,000 parameters, right? And so every person in the world. And so it's whack-a-mole with a trillion moles, right? And the problem is you whack down one and it comes up somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
Just like maybe in Uganda or so, right? And so it's very hard to control this because again, there's no grounding, right? It's just like these statistical regularities. You patch up one thing, and then something else might not work. And that's been documented. Now, there was a paper a couple of months ago that showed that tracking ChatGPT over time, that it gets better at some things, it gets worse at other things, because it's such this hugely complex model that we can't even begin to control, because again, a trillion parameters. And that's a huge problem if you think about ethics or so.
Yeah. So Max, what I'm hearing you saying is that scientists like you who are helping to develop this kind of thing are actually the enemy, that you're bringing terrible things into the world, that there's no positive benefit to the advances in technology in this area. Is that correct? Or
yeah, stuck up on canned goods, move to the basement. Yeah.
But seriously, no. So we've talked appropriately, I think, about the negatives and the potential real dangers. And I think, you know, humans are good at always seeing the potential dangers in advancing technology and kind of panicking. And sometimes we're actually right to do that. But give us the other side as well. What are the goods?
Yeah, no, it's great to like when you're able to ascertain, is that actually true? Is that useful? Right? I mean, then it's a great tool. So one of my kids, I can say that now because she went on to college. she was trying to get a job at Chick-fil-A, and then she had to write a cover letter. And so she said, "Well, it's a ChatGPT. Write me a cover letter for a job at Chick-fil-A for a girl who has 4 siblings and cares a lot," or something like that. And out came this beautiful cover letter talking about the fast-paced environment at Chick-fil-A. And her hiring manager said that was such a good cover letter. So I mean, for these rote tasks, right, it's great, right? That or like brainstorming if you want to prime the pump, right? I mean, that's all very useful. But if you don't know, right, is this right or wrong? And you have to take this as gospel. I mean, it's also an issue. And so, sorry, I'm being the Luddite again. But I mean, the issue is, if you don't know what this is, right, and this is also why some countries are concerned, right, is the answer going to be one I like, right? But here in the US, it's mostly what do the companies think should be the right answer, right? but again, if you can say, okay, this is a good answer or not, right? I mean, then it's a really useful tool. I mean, like cooking recipes or whatnot, right? Or packing lists. It's great because it's distilled all this stuff on the internet into something that says, okay, what's the most consistent pattern here? And that can be really useful.
Yeah. So thinking for a minute about consistent patterns and what we might conclude from a set of data as to what should be the next step. If I saw, you know, if I just picked up your resume and I was asked to guess your spiritual beliefs, I would not guess that you were a Christian. You're actually, you know, one of the demographics probably least likely to identify as Christian. You know, you like me come from Western Europe and we both come from sort of what are sometimes described as sort of post-Christian countries. I think Germany is probably even more post-Christian than the UK and some, you know, probably lower levels on average of sort of serious Christian faith. You're a science professor, you're a white man. All of these are against the likelihood of you being a follower of Jesus. So tell us, were you just like raised in a Christian family in Germany and carried on? Or tell us the story. How did we get... How did I get to call you brother rather than just professor?
Yeah. Well, you can always call me brother. But I was raised in a Catholic home, but it was more like cultural, right? And and then during college, especially grad school, it was all sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And only after I got married, right, then I realized, oops. I'm going to be in trouble. I'm going to really mess this up because I'm so selfish, right? That it was all about me. And I mean, as we know here, we can geek out. I mean, Romans 1, right? I mean, the issue is that we want to be in control, right? Because we don't want anyone to tell us what to do. I mean, especially here in America, right? And so, but yeah, then God by His grace, right? And then you hit a wall, right? And so I've done like jail ministry for a few years, right? And so, and I mean, people hit a wall, they realize whatever I've been doing hasn't worked out, right? And and that can be the best thing that ever happened to you, right? Because, yeah, you realize you're not in control, but there is someone who is, right? And he actually loves you. And so that is then the game changer. And so we all got to be hopefully brought to the point where we just cry out, okay, here, I need help. I didn't create this universe, right? But then then I started reading the Bible and then my wife and I took this online religion selector because, I mean, what do we know? Right? I mean, so it's kind of like these online surveys, like, which Disney princess are you, right? And so what do you think about God, right? And so, oh, yeah, I wanted to be like this, this, and this, right? And so that clearly wasn't an AI system. It, like, came out with these... I mean, the first was Baha'i, the second one was Orthodox Judaism as the best matches. I have no idea but we thought, okay, well, this sounds interesting. But and so then we took another religion selector, but by God's grace, we ended up at a great church, right? But I think it's this experience, and it's not like it's not a scientific experience, but much more visceral, right? That say, okay, here. And I think science, yeah, I mean, a lot of scientists don't believe, but a lot of scientists believe too. Because, I mean, when you, especially when you study the brain, I mean, you see how awesome it is, right? I mean, there's, as I already said, right? I mean, and you have 100 billion neurons, right? And they all are set. I mean, each neuron is just so complex, right? You say like, wow, all right, where did, it's just a wonderful experience then if you're a Christian, and then you get to do science you can also do great science without being a Christian, but I think then my colleagues are missing out, right? Because you really can then see here, wow, this points us to the Creator.
That's awesome. So Max, were you an assistant professor when you became a Christian, or I'm just trying to track, you were post PhD or you were in the tail end of your PhD?
Yeah, I was. I got married after I got my PhD, so I was a postdoc, and then I got the faculty position down here at Georgetown. It was kind of a gradual thing. And it's kind of like an oil tanker, just gaining speed, right?
Yeah.
So it's been a wild ride, and it's been awesome.
Love it. Well, thanks so much, Max, brother, for being willing to chat with me about all these fascinating things. I feel like I could talk to you for another 3 hours, but we'll save that for another time.
Sounds good.
You've been listening to the Confronting Christianity podcast. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter. And if you liked this episode, or if you hated it, or if you just felt indifferent about it, then please leave a review on iTunes. Feel free to include a question you'd like to see explored in future episodes. And you can join me next week. I'm going to be interviewing a friend who has a PhD in the Trinity, and I'm going to be asking her questions given to me by another friend who was raised Jewish and is exploring Christianity. Until then.